Thank you so much. God bless you all. Good morning, right, to you all. It's such a delight to be here. It's such a delight to have the family that was on the video with me here, my wife and five kids. For the first time, we've been able to actually be here together. So I'd like to thank them for their hard work in making that video. So in Matthew's gospel, Matthew chapter 11, verses 2 through 6, we're told about at least one thing that's essential to identifying Jesus as the Messiah, his miracles. Matthew tells us, quote, "Now when John heard in prison about the deeds of the Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, 'Are you he who is to come, or shall we look for another?'" Matthew records Jesus' answer, "Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up, and the poor have good news preached to them." In other words, Jesus is saying, "Yes, I am the Messiah, and the evidence is my miracles." Amen? Just making sure y'all paying attention at the get-go here. Now, what's interesting is that Jesus doesn't include that miracle that involves a particular alcoholic beverage. You know which one I'm talking about, right? I'm not talking about Cana. I'm talking about that miracle involving Boudreaux. I've heard about that one? You haven't? Well, let me tell y'all about Boudreaux. So, one night after the big Mardi Gras party, Boudreaux was driving home, and of course, he had a little bit too much to drink, so he's swerving all over the road, and lo and behold, the lights turn on in the back. God dog it, man, he pulls over on the side of the road. The sheriff gets out his car, walking up, approaching Boudreaux's car with his flashlight, and guess what? It's Boudreaux's best friend, Thibodeau. So Tib shines that light in the car and says, "Excuse me, sir, I need to see your license and your registration." And so Boudreaux, looking up with his squinty eyes with the light, says, "Tib, is that you?" "Boudreaux," Thibodeau responds, "yeah, it's me, Thibodeau, man." Boudreaux says, "Tib, I didn't know you become the sheriff, sir." Thibodeaux responds and says, "Man, yeah, Boudreaux, they made me the sheriff last week. I'm big stuff now. Now let me see your license and your registration." So Boudreaux, boy, he's getting his stuff out the glove box, and Thibodeau shines the light, and he sees in the cup holder an open bottle half full. So he said, Boudreaux, what you got there in that bottle, boy? Boudreaux said, "Oh, Tib, you ain't got to worry about that, sir. That's just my apple juice from the 7-Eleven, baby." Tib said, "Let me see that." So he took that bottle, he took a whiff. "Boudreaux, that ain't no apple juice. That's your moonshine, boy." Boudreaux said, "It is? Let me see that." Acting surprised, he takes a swig and says, "Tib, it is my moonshine. Praise be Jesus, he changed apple juice into moonshine. It's a miracle." And then Thibodeau said, "Well, boy, I guess since Jesus is with you, I gotta let you go." Now, my guess is that Jesus didn't include that miracle in his list of miracles because it's not included in the list of miracles recorded by Isaiah in Isaiah 35, 5 through 6, which Jesus appears to have in mind. Isaiah lists certain miracles that are gonna be brought about whenever God comes with vengeance, bringing salvation to his people in the Messianic age. It's also not a miracle in the list of the Messianic miracles in one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, Qumran Scroll 4Q521, also known as 4Q Messianic Apocalypse. In this document, we read about the Messiah setting prisoners free, opening the eyes of the blind, raising up those who are bowed down, healing the injured, making alive the dead, proclaiming good news to the afflicted. It appears that it's this prophetical background that we discover in Isaiah 35 and this Dead Sea Scroll that Jesus is alluding to in his response to whether he is the Messiah. So, in our quest to defend Peter's answer to the question, who do you say that I am? It's important that we get straight on whether Jesus was a miracle worker. Because it is the miracles of Christ, and as we will see, the ultimate miracle of his resurrection, that serves as the vindication for who Jesus says he is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, there are two questions that we need to answer to this end. Number one, are the gospel reports based on actual events in Jesus' ministry, as opposed to being mere made-up stories or legendary developments? Second, how do we know these deeds recorded by the gospels were genuine miracles? And this is an important question because it's one thing to say that Jesus did some things that led his audience to think they were miracles, and another thing to say they were actually miracles. If there is any gap between what they thought were miracles and what was actually miracles, a skeptic's always going to be able to plug the gap with some alternative naturalistic explanation. So let's take the first question. Are the gospel reports based on actual events? There are two approaches that we can take in answering this question. One general, the other more specific. So let's take the general approach first, which seeks to establish a general trust in the gospel reports that Jesus was a miracle worker. Now, right off the bat, it's important to note that we're justified in appealing to Christian sources. One ought not to reject Christian sources in seeking knowledge about Jesus simply because they are Christian. That would be like saying, we're going to reject Jewish sources and seeking knowledge about the Holocaust because they were Jewish. Or we're going to reject Roman sources and seeking knowledge about ancient Rome because they are Romans. So we're justified in appealing to Christian sources. With that out the way, the first way in which we can establish a general trust in the gospel reports that Jesus was a miracle worker is looking at the temporal proximity of the reports to the events that they are reporting about. So the synoptics, with regard to the synoptics, good arguments can be made that they were written within and right at 30 years removed from the events that they're reporting on. Mark within AD 55 to 60, Luke and Matthew 60 to 62. John, a little bit later, 60 or so years removed. Now compare that to the biographies, say, of Alexander the Great or Siddhartha Gautama the Buddha, 400 plus years removed from the events they're recording about. Or the six sources of Julius Caesar, which range from 90 to 200 years removed from the events these biographies report on. So when you compare the gospel reports about Jesus' ministry to these other biographies of ancient historical figures, the gospel reports win the day when it comes to temporal proximity to the events and their reliability. Now, there's another way that we can establish a general trust in the gospel reports about Jesus being a miracle worker, and that is by using what scholars call the criterion of embarrassment. This refers to the idea that when embarrassing details are recorded about a sympathetic historical figure, it's likely that those details are true, because the author wouldn't have any other reason to make up these embarrassing details. Kind of like the brochure at our last Catholic Answers conference, which stated that when I used to perform with my band on the bandstand back in the day in Louisiana playing Cajun music, I used to do so with leather pants and a spandex shirt. That's not a detail that Catholic Answers would want to make up, because that has the potential of undermining my credibility as a sophisticated Catholic Answers apologist. Now, one example of this criterion of embarrassment is Mark's account of the Pharisees' accusation that Jesus was performing exorcisms by the power of the devil. Mark records in Mark 3:22, he's possessed by Beelzebub, and by the prince of demons, he cast out the demons. It's unreasonable that Mark would make this story up, that Jesus is demonically possessed, when it has the potential to undermine Jesus' reputation, which would be counterproductive to Mark's purpose in writing his gospel to try to persuade his audience about Jesus. There's another criterion that applies here as well. The criterion of enemy attestation. The principle of enemy attestation states that when enemies of a person, a cause, or a message corroborate some given facts, it's likely those facts are true. Trent was referencing this criterion yesterday in his talk when he was talking about how the early Christians believed that Jesus was God and that they worshiped him as God. Enemies attested to that fact. And that gives us good reason to conclude that the early Christians believed Jesus was God and worshiped him as so. Now, notice Jesus' critics in Mark, the Pharisees, they don't deny that something supernatural happened. They simply offer an explanation other than Jesus having divine power. We can even extend the criterion of enemy attestation beyond the life of Jesus or the time of Jesus. Consider, for example, first century Jewish historian Flavius Josephus. In his Testimonium Flavianum, he attests that Jesus was a doer of wonderful works. We can also appeal to the second century philosopher Celsus, who wrote the first known full-scale attack against Christianity entitled True Doctrine. And like the Pharisees in Mark, Celsus doesn't deny that Jesus was performing wondrous deeds. He simply says Jesus was a magician or a sorcerer. Now, there's one more point to cap things off here. No one in the ancient world ever outright denied that Jesus was a wonder worker. Christian apologists Gregory Boyd and Paul Rhodes Eddy in their book, Lord or Legend, put the argument this way, quote, "This uniform agreement is difficult to explain on the assumption that the Jesus story was in fact a recently created legend at the time the Gospels were written. If it was indeed largely legendary, wouldn't at least some of the numerous critics of the early Jesus movement have raised this charge against it?" Reasonably so. But there is no charge against it. They all recognize he was a wonder worker of some sort, but offered alternative explanations to the divine power explanation. So, by appealing to temporal proximity of the reports to the events they're reporting on, and the criteria of embarrassment and enemy attestation, we can have a general confidence that what the Gospels report concerning Jesus's miraculous deeds is based on actual events in Jesus's ministry. Events that at least led his audience to think he was performing miracles. These are not just made up stories. These are not fictional stories in the sense of being made up or fictional in the sense of legendary developments. They are rooted in actual events in Jesus' ministry. Now, with our general approach finished, let's get a little bit more specific. For our more specific approach, we want to address two things. First, the evidence for Jesus as a healer. And it's important we do this because remember, from Isaiah and the Qumran scroll, healing miracles were essential, was considered to be essential to the Messiah's ministry. And then secondly, we want to look at evidence for Jesus' claim, the dead are raised up. And recall from the Qumran scroll, the raisings of the dead was also considered to be essential to the Messiah's ministry. So let's start with the claim that Jesus was a healer. As we already said, historians use a variety of criteria to determine the historicity of an event or saying in ancient literature. We already looked at two of them, enemy attestation and the criterion of embarrassment. Now, another criterion is multiple attestation. This is the principle that states the more often an event or a saying appears in independent sources, the more likely that event or saying is historical. Traditionally, it was commonly thought that each gospel represented an independent source. But since the time of literary criticism, one good thing that came out of it, it's commonly held that Mark wrote his gospel first, and Matthew and Luke largely relied on Mark's gospel for their gospels. Furthermore, many historians believe that Matthew and Luke actually shared a common source independent of Mark. Historians call it Q, which refers to Quelle, the German word for source. Now, Q's not without its doubters, but for the sake of argument, for our purposes here, we'll go with the majority consensus. Now, Matthew and Luke also had their own independent sources that they drew from, called special Luke tradition and special Matthew tradition. And since the Johannine tradition has always been considered independent from the synoptics, with this view, we have five independent sources in order to come to know about the ministry of Jesus. Now, that Jesus was a healer overwhelmingly meets the criterion of multiple attestation. With regard to specific narratives of specific healing miracles, there are 16 distinct, non-overlapping accounts in five out of the five independent sources. So, for example, I'm going to run through these real quick here. Mark records 8 healing narratives, 2 cures of a paralytic in chapter 2 and chapter 3, 2 cures of blindness in chapter 10 and chapter 8, 1 cure of leprosy in chapter 1, 3 cures that involve various diseases, a fever in chapter 1, hemorrhage in chapter 5, deafness in chapter 7. The one healing miracle in the Q source is the cure of a centurion servant at a distance, recorded in Luke chapter 7 and Matthew chapter 8. The special Luke tradition records 4 healing narratives. One involves a paralytic in chapter 13. Another concerns the curing of leprosy in chapter 17. 2 cures of various ailments, dropsy in chapter 14, and the ear of the slave of the high priest in chapter 22. The special Matthew tradition records the healing of 2 blind men in a house in Matthew chapter 9. And to round off our tally here, John relates 2 healings, one that involves the healing of a paralytic in chapter 5, and the other the healing of a blind man in chapter 9, and it's not Bartimaeus. So the 16 non-overlapping distinct narratives of healing miracles in 5 out of the 5 independent sources gives us good reason to conclude that the New Testament portrait of Jesus as a healer is trustworthy. That's to say, they're rooted in actual events in Jesus's ministry that led his audience to believe Jesus is a healer. And not just in the medicine sense, in the medical sense, but a miraculous healer. Now, we could also mention the non-narrative context in which Jesus as a healer is mentioned in passing, but I'm going to skip over that for now because we don't have time. Now, the second way that we can defend the claim that Jesus is a healer is to look at particular miracle stories of Jesus healing people and investigate whether the story itself is historically reliable. And we don't have time to do multiple ones here today, but I'll just focus on one, and that is the healing of the blind of Bartimaeus, the blind Bartimaeus, recorded in Mark chapter 10, verses 46 through 52. First of all, the story has a few Semitic details that reveal a connection to the early Palestinian community, which for historians is an indication of historical reliability. So, for example, you have the use of the Aramaic word Rabboni, which translates as master. You have the use of the title Son of David, which, interestingly enough, was not a title used by the early Christian community. And so that indicates that this story is rooted at the time of Jesus' ministry itself, before the Christian community began to develop and have its own life. The historicity of this healing miracle is also seen or supported by details that don't serve any apologetical or catechetical purposes. And so it indicates, these are details that indicate this is coming from an eyewitness. So, for example, Mark names the recipient of the miracle, Bartimaeus. He ties the named individual to a geographical place, the roadside outside of Jericho. He marks the point of Jesus' ministry. He's on his way up to Jerusalem before his passion and death, according to Mark 10:32. He marks the time of the miracle, shortly before Passover, according to Mark chapter 14, verse 1. These details strongly suggest that the story comes from an eyewitness. How else would somebody know all of these details? And if the story was fabricated, why would you even include all of these details? Moreover, according to famous Catholic biblical scholar John P. Meyer, it's probable that the eyewitness was Bartimaeus himself. New Testament scholar Richard Baucom, in his book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, confirms this thesis by arguing it's likely that the reason the names of figures like Bartimaeus were preserved is because these individuals became members of the Christian community after they were healed. And this rings true. Consider, for example, if someone came to Jesus and they were healed, but the Christian community never heard from them again, they just kind of went on their merry way, it's unlikely that the Christians would have, one, known their name, and two, have been able to remember their name and preserve the name in the oral tradition. So that the names are even preserved suggests that the one healed became a member of the Christian community. Contrast this with the father of the possessed boy that Jesus exorcises in Luke chapter 9, verses 40 through 44. He's unnamed, unlike Jairus, who is named. It's likely that the father of the possessed boy didn't become a member of the Christian community, whereas Jairus did. So that the name is even preserved suggests that the eyewitness of the event is Bartimaeus himself. And in becoming a member of the Christian community, he would have been the primary tradition bearer of the event, knowing the details of the story and being able to transmit it throughout throughout his lifetime, and then it being preserved in those around him, with those around him in succeeding generations. So when we take into consideration the story of the healing of the blind man Bartimaeus and the multiple attestation of Jesus being a healer, we have good reason to conclude once again that the New Testament portrait of Jesus as a healer is rooted in actual events and deeds performed by Christ that at least led his audience to believe he was a healer. These are not fabricated stories just made up out of thin air, nor are they fiction in the sense of legendary developments. They're rooted in history. Now we come to our second specific line of defense of the gospel portrait of Jesus as a miracle worker, and that is his raising people from the dead. One thing that this claim has going for it is multiple attestation. It's found in 4 out of the 5 independent sources. So we have, for example, Mark recording Jairus' daughter in Mark chapter 5. Luke and Matthew record the healing, the raising of Jairus' daughter as well, but they're drawing from Mark. We have the son of the widow of Nain in special Luke tradition, recorded in Luke chapter 7. We have the raising of Lazarus in John chapter 11. And then, of course, we have the special Matthew tradition in Matthew chapter 11, verses 2 through 6, which we refer to at the beginning of the talk. So the claim that Jesus raised people from the dead is multiply attested to. And that's a good indication that this claim is rooted in history. It's not fabricated. It's not fiction. Another point in favor of the claim is that there is a lack of exaggeration concerning this type of miracle of raising people from the dead. Mark, Matthew, and John only confine themselves to one account of Jesus raising someone from the dead. Luke has 2. He has his own, the raising of the son of the widow of Nain, and then he repeats the raising of Jairus' daughter. But think about it, guys. If these authors were, if these Christians were making this stuff up, you would expect that they would appeal to the raisings of raising people from the dead more often, right? I mean, that's a pretty extraordinary feat to raise somebody from the dead. If I were making that stuff up, man, I'd have it all over the place. But we don't. The lack of exaggeration is a key indication that the authors are committed to the historical facts. Now, we can also look to the stories themselves, like we did with the healing of Bartimaeus. We can actually look to the specific narrative itself of the raising of the dead. And in particular, we can look at, for example, the raising of Jairus' daughter in Mark chapter 5, verses 21 through 43. And by the way, some of this material I have in my book, well, I thought it was right here. I think my boss took my book, man. Well, you saw Chris waving my book, Prepare the Way. In my book, Prepare the Way, I have a few chapters, or a chapter. Ah, thank you, boss man. So in my book, Prepare the Way, I have a chapter where I'm dealing with the historical reliability of the Gospels. You can also get a copy of the magazine where I have an article detailing some of this information. So if you can't assimilate it all in like 35 minutes, don't worry. Just buy the book, Prepare the Way, and I'll sign it for you if you want. So let's look at the raising of Jairus' daughter. First, the high status of Jairus as a synagogue official within the region of Galilee makes the event hypothetically checkable. It's not like it's a miracle being performed for some unknown Joe Schmo in the middle of nowhere, right? This is a high-ranking official, so it makes it hypothetically checkable. Second, as we mentioned before, that Jairus' name is even preserved suggests that he became a member of the Christian community, and thus the primary tradition bearer for the raising of his daughter. Mark also tells us in Mark 5:37 that Jesus brought into the house with him Peter, James, and John. So we have further eyewitness testimony of this event that they believe to be a raising from the dead. And having further eyewitness testimony would ensure that Jairus is not fudging the facts a little bit to make things a little bit extraordinary. And having Jairus as the eyewitness sort of checks the apostles and precludes them from fudging the facts a little bit to make things feel a little extraordinary. So we have eyewitness testimony. Fourth, this story meets the criterion of embarrassment. Remember, we're told by Mark how when Jesus went into the house and he sent the mourners out and said, she's only sleeping, Mark tells us they laughed at him. Now, that would have left a bitter taste in the mouths of the early Christians. So if they were making this stuff up, they wouldn't have recorded that embarrassing detail in the oral tradition. They wouldn't have preserved that. So it meets the criterion of embarrassment. Also, the story contains unique semitisms. These are grammatical or syntactical details that reveal the influence of the Semitic language. And scholars view the presence of semitisms as providing good reason to think that the story has its origin in a Palestinian community at the time of Jesus. Now, one in particular is Talitha Kum, which is Aramaic for a little girl, I say to you, rise. But not only is the phrase significant because it's in Aramaic, but also, as Father Robert Spitzer points out in his book, God So Loved the World, it's in popular Aramaic as opposed to formal or written Aramaic, which would have been Talitha Kumi. It's akin to, you know, me saying y'all versus you all, or that ain't gonna happen versus that will not happen, right? Now, why would Mark preserve this informal way of speaking? Perhaps because he was trying to preserve the expression as it came from the lips of Jesus. And this is reasonable. We could imagine that, you know, if somebody were transcribing my talk here this morning or this afternoon, whatever time it is right now, the transcriber wouldn't change my southern expressions into proper English. Why? Because it manifests who I am. I'm a southerner, right? I'm a southern boy from southwest Louisiana. And so it comes out. And so the transcriber would want to preserve that for the readers of the transcript to know that I'm a southerner. Similarly, it's likely that Mark doesn't alter Jesus' colloquial mode of speech because he's trying to preserve the Galilean dialect of Aramaic as it came from the lips of Jesus. And the late Jewish scholar Giza Vermish makes this same point in his book, The Changing Faces of Jesus, on page 268, if you want to check that out. Finally, it's worth noting that in this story of the raising of Jairus' daughter, there's a lack of Christological titles in the narrative. This would have been a perfect opportunity for the gospel writers to give Jesus a post-resurrection title like Lord, because Jesus is manifesting his power over life and death here, so they believe. This would have been a perfect opportunity, but they don't. In fact, Mark, Matthew, and Luke all refer to Jesus only as teacher in the narrative. So, given the multiple attestation that Jesus raised people from the dead, the lack of exaggeration concerning these reports, and the historicity of the specific narrative of the raising of Jairus' daughter, we can conclude that the records of Jesus raising people from the dead is historically reliable. They are rooted in things Jesus did that led his audience to think, this dude raised people from the dead, Jack. And that's some pretty cool stuff, man. Boudreaux would have been pretty cool. He would have said, Matt Dib, that's some better miracle than that moonshine, Bubba, let me tell you. I tell you what, after drinking too much moonshine, Boudreaux might drop dead and might need to be raised up by Jesus, right? Okay, so let's take stock of where we've been so far. We've established, number one, a general trust in the gospel reports that Jesus did things that led people to believe that he was a miracle worker. We appeal to temporal proximity, the criteria of embarrassment, and the criterion of enemy attestation. Second, we also establish the credibility of specific gospel reports that people believe Jesus was a healer and that he raised people from the dead. And so this gives us abundant evidence that Jesus was doing things that led people to think he was a miracle worker. These reports are not fiction in the sense of being made up stories, nor are they fiction in the sense of being legendary developments. They're rooted in history. Now we come to the question, how do we know these deeds of Jesus recorded by the Gospels were genuine miracles? And recall, we said earlier The question is important because it's one thing to say they thought they were miracles and another thing to say they were actually miracles. Now, you might think, since you're all sympathetic to miraculous claims, you generally might think, well, yeah, I'll just make the jump and say, yeah, they were actually miracles. But if you're skeptical to miraculous claims, you're not going to be inclined to make that jump, especially without convincing evidence. As long as there is some gap between what they thought were miracles and what was actually miracles, as a skeptic, you're just going to plug the gap with some naturalistic explanation. So we need to figure out how to close that gap between what they thought were miracles and them actually being miracles. Now, there are several approaches that we can take. We could possibly try to appeal to the reports themselves, but unfortunately, that's a dead end because the reports don't give us the details that we would need to close that gap and to show that, yeah, these are actual miracles. Even the reports of Jesus raising Jairus' daughter from the dead, there's nothing in the narrative that would give us good reason to conclude she was actually dead, and therefore this is a real raising from the dead. A skeptic could always say, well, maybe they thought she was dead. She was almost dead, unconscious, so it wasn't really a raising from the dead. Now, you might think, well, what about Lazarus? He was 4 days in the tomb. That's a possible approach. But that presupposes a whole project of defending the historicity of John's gospel. Another possible approach is we could appeal to Jesus' trustworthiness. Because remember, John 10:38, Jesus believed he was performing miracles, right? Jesus said, you don't believe me, believe the works. So maybe we could appeal to Jesus' trustworthiness and that he was aware of what he was doing. But that presupposes that we can trust Jesus. But how do we know we can trust Jesus? Well, the ultimate way in which we know we can trust Jesus is through his resurrection. And so I would suggest that the best approach to take in order to close that gap between what they thought were miracles and what were actually miracles is to show that Jesus, in fact, rose the dead. And I think this approach will meet the criterion of what Jimmy calls bulletproof apologetics. Now, I don't have time to give a full-blown defense of the resurrection, so we'll have to settle for a brief one here. But we all know that the early Christians claimed that Jesus rose from the dead, and they viewed the resurrection as the best explanation of certain historical facts surrounding his resurrection. His death, the empty tomb, his burial, the empty tomb, and the postmortem appearances. Now, skeptics, however, will challenge the Christian claim and offer alternative explanations for the historical facts that Christians are explaining with Christ's physical and glorified resurrection. So if we can show that these alternative explanations, we'll look at the major ones here today, fail in their explanatory power, well then the Christian explanation wins the day. And that would give us grounds to conclude, as a matter of historical fact, as the Catechism puts it in paragraph 643, I think, Tim Staples, you might have to help me out on that one, that it is a historical fact. So what are some of these alternative explanations? Let's consider one, the conspiracy theory. This says that the early Christians stole Jesus' body from the tomb and lied about his resurrection. Now, this does explain the empty tomb. It does explain the alleged postmortem appearances. And it even explains the claim that Jesus is Lord. However, it fails on other points. So, for example, it doesn't adequately explain why the gospel writers record women as the first witnesses of the empty tomb and the resurrected Jesus. That's a detail that would harm rather than support or affirm their credibility. Why? Because in first century Judaism, the testimony of women was not acceptable, especially in the court of law. So for example, consider what Josephus says here in his Antiquities of the Jews. But let not the testimony of women be admitted on account of the levity That is, they didn't take things seriously, and boldness of their sex. Don't throw the stones at me. If a woman's testimony was not considered credible in first century Judaism, it's unlikely the apostles would have included, if they were making this stuff up, it's unlikely they would have included women as the first witnesses, especially when they're creating an apology here, especially when they're trying to persuade their readers about Jesus. It would have been better if they're fabricating the story to choose men as the first witnesses of the empty tomb and the resurrected Jesus. Say, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. They could have just put them in rather than the women. But they did put the women in, thus suggesting that is historically accurate. They're putting it there because it's true. Furthermore, the conspiracy theory doesn't fit with the early Christian belief in a resurrected Messiah. As Anglican scholar, New Testament scholar N.T. Wright notes in his book, The Resurrection of the Son of God, first century Jews were not expecting anyone to rise before the end of time. So a resurrected Messiah is not something that would persuade the Jews to join the new religion. Why make this up when it's going to have no consequence, no traction with your audience, when they're not even hoping for a resurrected Messiah? And finally, the conspiracy theory fails because it doesn't explain why the early Christians went to their deaths for the resurrected Christ, especially when they had everything to lose and nothing to gain. It is true that somebody might die for what they know to be a lie. That's possible if you have something to gain. I remember watching Blue Bloods one time. You ever watch that? And I remember the daddy, he went to prison in order to keep his daughter who committed a murder from undergoing capital punishment. And I remember watching that show, and I thought to myself, oh man, I keep saying that the apostles wouldn't die for what they knew to be a lie, but this dude's about to die for what he knows to be a lie. And then it dawns on me, but this dude has something to gain, namely his daughter remaining alive. But the apostles, they had nothing to gain and everything to lose for lying about the resurrection. The conspiracy theory does not explain that historical fact that they died for the resurrection when they had nothing to gain and everything to lose. Now, another alternative theory is the swoon theory. Perhaps Jesus did not die, but he just fell unconscious. And when he was put in the tomb, he came to and he got out. Appeared to the apostles. Apostles said, hallelujah, Jesus is risen. Unfortunately, for the swoon theorists, the swoon theory does not explain the historical facts. First of all, it totally disregards the historical evidence that Jesus died, evidence that comes not only from ancient Christian sources, but from non-Christian sources as well, like from Josephus and Cornelius Tacitus. Second, doesn't adequately explain the detail it attempts to explain, namely, the empty tomb. Is it reasonable to believe that a half-dead Jesus who had been whipped and beaten, nailed to a cross for hours, fell unconscious, and had the strength to remove the stone that was covering the tomb? And this half-dead Jesus getting past the guards and making his way to safety unseen? I don't think so, my friends. A half-dead man covered in blood is a far cry from the idea of a glorious victor over death who miraculously ascends into heaven. The swoon theory does not account for the glorious, miraculous feats of the resurrected Jesus appearing and disappearing, walking through walls, ascending into heaven in a miraculous way. So the swoon theory fails as well. Other theories, like the hallucination theory, the vision theory and the spiritual resurrection theory, which states that Jesus' spirit merely appeared in bodily form, fail because they do not account for the empty tomb, which is a well-established historical fact. If these theories were true, well, then the critics could have easily produced the body and exposed the fraud with regard to the claim that Jesus rose from the dead. And we know the empty tomb is a historical fact. It's based upon eyewitness testimony with regard to the women and Peter and John. It meets the criterion of early testimony. Paul's creedal formula in 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 5, where he writes Christ died, was buried, and rose again. Scholars date to as early as AD 39. This is a creedal formula that was given to Paul and is rooted in only 6 years after the resurrection of Jesus. And furthermore, the message that Jesus rose from the dead was preached in Jerusalem. It's not like the apostles were in some faraway place saying, oh, Jesus has risen from the dead, hallelujah, and the people have no access to the tomb to verify the claim. It was preached in Jerusalem. And so for these reasons, the hallucination theory, the vision theory, or the spiritual resurrection theory fail to explain the historical fact of the empty tomb. Now, my friends, as with all historical events, it's impossible to have absolute 100% certitude with regard to the resurrection based on historical evidence alone. However, when one considers the evidence of the historicity of the details that the resurrection of Christ explains, and that all of the alternative naturalistic explanations by skeptics fail, we have good reason to conclude as a matter of historical fact, as I mentioned in paragraph 643 of the Catechism, that Jesus, in fact, rose from the dead. And if Jesus' resurrection is genuine, and he indeed rose from the dead, well, then all of the other smaller miracles is a piece of cake. If Jesus, in fact, rose from the dead, then his other miracles are indeed genuine. And if Jesus' miraculous deeds are real miracles, then we with confidence, brothers and sisters, can profess with Peter in response to the question of who do you say that I am, we can say you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Amen? Amen. I say praise be Jesus Christ. You say now and forever praise be Jesus Christ. Now and forever. Praise be Jesus Christ. Praise be Jesus Christ! Give it up for Jesus! Thank you all. God bless you.